ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. This Tuesday, price check. Supermarkets urge to use clearer price labelling. And the future of Kokoda concerns the track is falling into disrepair as the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese prepares to tackle the historic path.
It's in the worst condition it's ever been in the 32 years I've trekked across it. Now, there are areas along the Brown River that are potential death traps. Nothing's going to happen until somebody slips into that river and is not found.
A showdown is looming between tech entrepreneur Elon Musk and the Australian government. The government's eSafety Commissioner has won a two-day injunction in the federal court ordering Mr. Musk's social media platform X to hide videos and images of a stabbing at a Sydney church. X's Australian lawyers say they will fight the order when it returns to court. Elon Musk has accused the government of censorship, but Anthony Albanese says Mr. Musk is an arrogant billionaire who thinks he's above the law. Rachel Mealy reports.
Billionaire Elon Musk is no stranger to a public stoush. His latest adversary, Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. The tech entrepreneur has accused the Australian government of censorship after the eSafety Commissioner won her bid to have his platform take down videos of a violent attack on a bishop in a Sydney church. Today, the Prime Minister hit back.
We'll do what's necessary to take on this arrogant billionaire who thinks he's above the law, but also above common decency. What the eSafety Commissioner is doing is doing her job to protect the interests of Australians. And the idea that someone would go to court for the right to put up violent content on a platform shows how out of touch Mr. Musk is. A social media needs to have social responsibility with it. Mr. Musk is not showing any.
The spat has sparked a wider debate about the influence of social media companies. Tasmanian Senator Jackie Lambie says the powers of the eSafety Commissioner are designed for just this kind of scenario.
Elon Musk has no social conscience or conscience whatsoever. I don't know, whatever Elon Musk is on, it says that that's okay to continue to air that is absolutely disgusting behaviour. And quite frankly, the bloke should be jailed. And the sooner that we can bring rules in or do something about this sort of game playing with our social media, the better off we're going to be.
ACT Senator David Pocock wants a larger conversation about the conduct of social media companies.
These companies are often not good faith actors. They are monetizing our attention. They're serving us ads. We are the product when we use things like Meta, you know, Facebook, Instagram. And I'm really concerned about the effect that that's having on all of us. And these multinational companies have proven time and time again that they're willing to bully governments and countries like Australia and not uphold their part of the bargain of being able to run their businesses here in Australia.
But the National Senator, Matt Canavan, is concerned that the court's decision on this matter will lead to wider censorship.
What the Prime Minister is trying to do here is to use a violent stabbing, a terrible incident in Western Sydney, to say somehow he now needs a government power to tell you what you can say. Are we going to enter a world where Australian individuals effectively need a licence to speak their mind?
The platform X had hidden the content from Australian users, but overseas users could still see the violent footage. The eSafety Commissioner says this doesn't comply with Australian law. Dr. Rob Nichols is a Senior Research Associate in Media and Communications at the University of Sydney. He says the federal court is concerned that if the footage is still available to be shared overseas, it could make its way back to Australian users.
If it's available for access, the risk of it being reshared, so somebody with a virtual private network in Australia gets access to the content, brings it back into Australia and then reshares it on another social media platform or even on Twitter, then the process gets to be, oh, well, we found it here, we'll stop it, we'll block it. We found it there, we'll block it. Whereas a takedown actually means that the material won't be reshared in Australia.
The federal court injunction is due to end on Wednesday.
That's Rachel Mealy reporting. While plenty of Australians like the idea of rooftop solar, it's out of reach for some. Those who rent, live in an apartment or have heritage restrictions on their property often miss out. But now some are investing in renewable energy and reaping the financial benefits. It's been dubbed Australia's first solar garden and it's being launched this weekend. Here's the ABC's climate reporter, Jo Lauder.
Justine Lloyd is moving out of her Sydney apartment after 17 years. But there's one large item she doesn't have to pack.
The way that it's set up that I don't have to pack up my solar panels and take them with me every time I move.
A couple of years ago, Justine bought into a co-op for solar energy. That means instead of having the panels on her home, they're sitting 500 kilometres away on a property near the town of Grongrong in the New South Wales Riverina.
So what interested me about it was that we're in a transition. The electricity system, power system has to change, and a huge number of people are locked out of that change at the retail or consumer level.
It's a new type of initiative called a solar garden. The electricity that Justine's panels generate is sold into the grid, and then her retailer provides a credit onto her bill. The Haystack Solar Farm sold its plots of solar for $4,200, and it's a 3-kilowatt solar plot. The solar gardeners will get at least $500 off their bill each year for the next decade. Jonathan Prendergast is one of the farm's directors.
So Grongrong Solar Farm is around 1.5 megawatts and has a value of around $3-4 million. The more common solar farms can be from 30 megawatts, $40 million, up to 200 or 400 megawatts.
He says the project is aimed at people who can't get solar on their own rooftops.
We have a bit of the haves and have-nots. People with rooftop solar are protected from the energy market ups and downs. Whereas renters, apartment dwellers that can't get rooftop solar can take advantage of these sorts of models to reduce their energy bills.
And it's owned by the members.
Community energy is where local communities band together to try and create a concept, develop a project and finance and even own the project.
The solar farm is based on Grongrong farmer Gemma Purcell's land. She started working on the idea with Jonathan Prendergast almost a decade ago.
I was becoming eternally grumpy and frustrated with the inertia at government level in terms of climate action, emissions reduction, you know, the energy transition.
She says the panels fit in with a mix of produce that they already grow.
Here on the farm, for us as farmers, we sort of mixed cropping and wool and beef. It just is a really positive environmental action we could take. In terms of the scale of the farm, the solar garden itself is about the size of a Bunnings car park.
Dr. Bjorn Sternberg is an energy expert at the Australian National University. He's impressed with the solar garden, but he thinks there are better ways to go about making the energy system fairer.
I think it's really important to be clear that initiatives like this solar garden are never going to be as beneficial as rooftop solar. And that really emphasises that as a society and as a political system really needs to continue to work heavily on equity and fairness in the energy system and in the energy transition.
That's because people with rooftop solar can use that power without having to pay network costs. And Dr. Sternberg believes that there should be a greater focus on increasing the amount of renewable technology across the grid.
The best thing we can do is to accelerate the transition of the whole national electricity grid to be more renewables and therefore cleaner and cheaper. Once that's the case, there'll be less of an imbalance between those who rent and those who own properties and have solar.
Dr. Sternberg thinks other measures like mandatory energy efficiency standards will also help renters access the benefits of renewables.
Here it is absolutely inescapable and of utmost importance that we also help rental properties and apartments for that matter and social housing have more efficient and electrified homes.
But for Justine Lloyd, becoming a solar gardener is an important step forward.
I get to be part of that climate and energy solution.
That report from Jo Lauder. Well, major supermarkets are being accused of confusing and potentially misleading customers with discount labelling. A survey by consumer group Choice shows one in four people couldn't tell where the price tags reflected a genuine discount. Choice says it's more evidence that strict pricing rules are needed across the supermarket sector. But one expert argues that labels aren't a big issue for shoppers, as Stephanie Smale reports.
As budgets get tighter, more and more shoppers are scouring the supermarket aisles for bargains. Some say they're savvy and don't need discount clues.
I read the fine print. I have a look at things like grams or how many sheets per a roll of something and so on, and I think that that's a better way of judging it than the coloured ticket.
Do your research, have a look, move on if it's not suiting.
But others are concerned that what they're seeing on discount labels isn't a clear reflection of what they'll get.
I feel like they're kind of misleading. It's like they market things as like lower prices, but it just feels like it's not right.
There is widespread confusion about what the different labels and terms mean.
That's Choice Director of Campaigns, Rosie Thomas. She says a survey of more than 1,000 people found one in four aren't clear about what the labels mean. She explained some customers are unsure what phrases like while stocks last, down, down, member price or super savers actually deliver in savings.
For each of the labels that we've tested in our survey, a substantial proportion of consumers are getting it wrong. And that means they either think it's a discount and it's not, or they think it's not a discount and it actually is. Now, we think in a cost of living crisis, this is a really important point to highlight.
Supermarket labelling is one of a long list of issues being investigated by the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission. Rosie Thomas says Choice's discount labelling survey is part of the advocacy group's broader submission.
We think that now is the opportunity to create some stronger rules and really put the obligation on the supermarkets.
But one retail expert is challenging the idea there's anything wrong with supermarket discount and promotional labelling. Queensland University of Technology retail expert Professor Gary Mortimer argues if one in four customers are confused, that means the majority of shoppers know what's what.
I give Aussie shoppers more credit. I think we're reasonably smart, savvy consumers. I think when you walk into your local convenience store or supermarket or discount department store, you can read the label and I think those labels are very clear. Yeah, I do accept that there is a smaller proportion that may be confused over some of the terminology, but I also think it very much depends on how those questions were asked or what was actually shown.
So do you think there's any room for the major supermarket chains to overhaul their labelling?
I don't think we can ultimately end up in a situation where we legislate that all retailers have to use on-sale or not-on-sale terminology consistently across every brand.
The World Today has contacted both Coles and Woolworths to ask them about the way specials are displayed. Coles says the supermarket offers specials mechanisms to help customers find value, and the company's goal is to always be as clear as possible. Woolworths says the company works hard to ensure it complies with all Australian consumer laws and communicates prices clearly and accurately.
It's Stephanie Smale and Rachel Hayter reporting. You're listening to The World Today. Former US President Donald Trump has maintained his innocence on the first day of the first criminal case against him. Opening arguments were presented in the trial in a New York City courthouse. Prosecutors allege Mr. Trump paid hush money to adult film star Stormy Daniels in an effort to influence the outcome of the 2016 presidential election. Michael Cizak is a reporter with Associated Press covering the case.
It's absolutely unprecedented. This is the first time a former U.S. president has been a defendant in a criminal trial. And on Monday, the first time opening statements in a trial of a former president who's also a current candidate for the office and running as the presumptive Republican nominee. Unprecedented all around, history at every turn.
What kind of case is the prosecution outlining in these 34 felony charges against Mr. Trump?
The case in New York has been labeled as the hush money case, but prosecutors really want to portray it as an election interference case. prosecutors outlined what they said was a scheme really to suppress information from voters. They argue that Trump, the publisher of a supermarket tabloid, the National Enquirer, and Trump's longtime former lawyer, Michael Cohen, were involved in a conspiracy to identify and suppress negative stories about Trump. And by doing so, they hid information from voters. The prosecutor, Colangelo, suggested this could have very well been the tipping point in the election in Trump's victory over Hillary Clinton, his Democratic rival.
Michael, what argument has the defense put forward today?
Trump's lawyer, Todd Blanche, argued that Donald Trump is innocent, that he did not commit any crimes, and that this case really should never have been brought. That Donald Trump was forced to defend himself, not necessarily as a politician, but as a person looking out for his family, his reputation, and his brand. And that when people came forward or were about to come forward with stories that were negative about him, he had to take action. He had to fight back. Todd Blanche said that, you know, Trump is a fighter. That's what he does. They also made the argument that Trump was distant from any of the mechanics of these allegations. Trump's lawyers say he really wasn't involved. He signed the checks, but he wasn't checking the paperwork. He wasn't looking at it. He didn't see what the invoices said. There is no case.
Michael, how would you describe the level of public interest in this case?
There is certainly extraordinary public interest in this case because it is unfolding during the presidential election season in the United States. And this may be the only one of the four cases against Donald Trump that actually makes it to trial. You also have Donald Trump in court every day, 4 days a week, essentially turning the courtroom and the hallway outside the courtroom where he's able to talk to TV cameras into a somewhat of a campaign stage, bringing the campaign to the court.
Is there a sense that this case will damage Donald Trump's campaign as the presumptive Republican nominee?
People who are staunch supporters of Donald Trump feel that he is being railroaded. They agree with his assessment that this is a witch hunt. But there are other voters, polling shows, that will not vote for a convicted felon, for instance, for president. There are also questions of how this impacts his standing with women. But as this plays out, we will be looking more and more to the polling and to see how this plays with not only Donald Trump's base, but some of those voters who maybe are undecided or in the middle, that portion of the electorate that typically will decide the election.
That's Mike Cizek there, reporter with the Associated Press. An independent review of the UN agency helping Palestinian refugees has found that it must do more to improve its neutrality, staff vetting, and transparency. But it also says that Israel failed to provide evidence that many of the agency's staff belong to terror groups. After the October 7th attack by Hamas, Israel claimed that some of UNRWA's staff were involved, leading some countries, including Australia, to freeze funding. Nell Whitehead has more.
16 countries suspended funding to UNRWA, the agency responsible for delivering aid to Palestinian refugees, after Israel alleged that some of its staff took part in the October 7th Hamas attacks. In a report released on Monday, an independent investigation found that Israel had failed to provide evidence to substantiate its claims that many of the agency's staff in Gaza are members of terrorist organizations. Former French Foreign Minister Catherine Colonna led the review.
Overall, the findings of the review are that UNRWA is in place a very significant number of mechanisms and procedures to ensure compliance with the humanitarian principle of neutrality. Actually, it probably have a more developed system than other UN organizations or agencies.
The review found UNRWA had shared its staff lists with Israel since 2011, and that Israel had not raised any concerns about its employees until it claimed in January that 12 of the agency's staff had taken part in the October 7th attacks. Israel stepped up its accusations in March, saying that over 450 UNRWA staff belonged to Gaza terrorist groups. The report says that Israel has yet to provide supporting evidence of this. But it also found that while UNRWA has robust procedures to uphold the UN principle of neutrality, more must be done to improve its neutrality and staff vetting in practice.
I would like to stress that the international community has a responsibility in helping and supporting UNRWA in addressing neutrality issues. Globally speaking, in its mission, including in helping the agency to address these difficult challenges it faces sometimes. It is a shared responsibility.
UNRWA has for decades been the main organisation providing aid to Palestinians in Gaza. The report's recommendations include steps to tackle the politicisation of its staff and to implement zero tolerance for discrimination in the textbooks used in its schools. The UN has pledged to implement those in full. The findings have been welcomed by the US State Department. Matthew Miller is its spokesperson.
Certainly, we welcome the fact that the Secretary General has accepted the recommendations. We have long made clear that there needs to be reforms at UNRWA, and we would welcome the UN making the reforms that former Foreign Minister Colonna made in her report. But certainly, we have always made clear that we think the role that UNRWA plays is indispensable in providing and facilitating the delivery of humanitarian assistance, not just in Gaza, but in the broader region. We continue to support the work that they do.
Israeli authorities have long complained about the agency and have rejected the report's findings. A foreign ministry spokesperson, Oren Marmerstein, wrote in a statement that Hamas has infiltrated UNRWA so deeply that it's no longer possible to determine where UNRWA ends and Hamas begins. Chris Gunness is a former chief spokesperson for UNRWA and says the agency has been under political attack.
The allegations that triggered this crisis, that saw this massive famine, remain unsubstantiated. So it would seem that the Israeli claims amount to the mother of all lies, and that intelligence dossier it was based on, that intelligence dossier, was a dodgy dossier.
Israel's allegations against UNRWA led to $450 million in funding being suspended. Several of the countries which paused their funding, including Australia, have since resumed it. But the UN now says a famine is imminent in northern Gaza.
That's Neil Whitehead. Today, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and his PNG counterpart James Marape are beginning a two-day trek along the Kokoda Track, following the journey of Australian soldiers who successfully repelled Japan from Australia's doorstep. The track is a rite of passage for many Australians, but some who guide tourists along the 96-kilometre trail say it is in a dangerous condition. Angus Randall reports.
Anthony Albanese has a long day of walking ahead as he becomes the first sitting Australian Prime Minister to trek part of the Kokoda Track ahead of Anzac Day commemorations on Thursday.
It will be an honour to pay tribute to them, but also to show respect for all those men and women who've served in the Australian Defence Force.
More than 600 Australians were killed on the track during the Second World War as they repelled Japanese soldiers from claiming Port Moresby. Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister James Marape is also taking part in the trek, joking he'll be the Australian leader's bodyguard.
The next possibly 30 hours of our journey together in the mountains, or 36 hours, I choose to be your number one security guard.
Thousands of Australians walk the Kokoda Track every year. It's a tough hike with only the most basic facilities across the 96-kilometre trail. But some, like veteran tourism operator Charlie Lynn, worry it's falling into disrepair.
There's not a single toilet across the entire Kokoda Trail that meets the most basic hygiene needs of these trekkers.
He says it's about more than just hot showers. There are significant safety concerns about the track.
It's in the worst condition it's ever been in the 32 years I've trekked across it. Now, there are areas along the Brown River that are potential death traps. Nothing's going to happen until somebody slips into that river and is not found again.
Not every tour operator agrees. Fellow trek leader Mick O'Malley says PNG is doing the best it can for such a remote trail.
It could always be better, you know, without a doubt. But in terms of safety, that's the main thing that we want, is to make sure the Kokoda Trail is actually safe. We're bloody head and shoulders above where we used to be when I first started trekking.
Gary Jaffa is the governor of Oro Province, which covers the northern end of the track. He hopes to use the Prime Minister's visit to highlight local concerns.
We see it as an opportunity also to express to them the need for two leaders to understand the plight of the people of Kokoda and the province indeed in maintaining this iconic trail.
Who's in charge of the upkeep of the Kokoda Track is complicated. The Kokoda Track Authority was established by the PNG government about 20 years ago. It's partially funded by the Australian government. Critics of the setup say Australia has outsized influence over its management.
This is Papua New Guinea. This is our country, our law, our resources.
Papua New Guinea is not a territory of Australia anymore. We're an independent state, a sovereign nation.
Andy Abel is the deputy chairman of the PNG government's Tourism Promotion Authority. He says the track should be managed as a tourism asset through his department.
It's a dysfunctional mess, and that's what's driven me to right the wrongs and ensure that Kokoda Trail is realigned under the correct government agency, which is the Tourism Promotion Authority.
The ABC has approached the Kokoda Track Authority for comment. The Prime Minister's trek will end with an Anzac Day dawn service in the village of Ishurava.
A report from Angus Randall and Kyle Evans. That's all from The World Today for this Tuesday. We'll be back on the airwaves this time tomorrow. I'm Sally Sara. Take care.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. More Australians are finding themselves in a position where their power bills are rising because they've been unwittingly subjected to time-of-use tariffs. Today, energy reporter Dan Mercer explains the tariffs and how they're leading to a greater energy divide. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.